This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Anyhow.
Zero to controversy in 2 seconds, folks.
Right. All right, fine.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please join me welcoming our distinguished special guest for this week, Jessica Sutter. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Mike.
Jessica is the founder and president of EdPro Consulting and the Ward 6 member on the D.C. State Board of Education.
Woo-hoo.
Very exciting. And saying woo-hoo was my colleague, David Griffin.
I'm sorry, was that out loud?
I don't know. Was that because you're a Ward 6 resident?
It might be.
It might be. Okay. Woohoo. That is.
Constituents in the house.
That is Capitol Hill for those of you outside D.C.
We'll keep it objective, folks.
There you go. And I love it. The D.C. State Board of Education, it's sort of aspiring to be a state.
It's aspirational.
It is aspirational. Jessica, so great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Oh, by the way, this is totally random, but I have always had this question about why is it that after the Civil War, did the Union not get Arlington back? You know, if you look at D.C., it used to be a perfect diamond. Okay, it's no longer a diamond because the part that Virginia once upon a time gave for D.C., they took back. Well, I thought they took it back during the Civil War. It turns out that's not the case. They took it back in like the 1840s over some people in Alexandria just wanted it back. And there was some dispute over slave owning, da-da-da-da-da-da. But still,
a fitting
D.C. should take it back. We should take back Arlington, right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. But I digress. So Jessica is here to talk about school reform in the District of Columbia. Let's do that on Ed Reform Update. All right, Jessica. Well, you know, we can't help but pay attention to what's happening here in our backyard. And for good reason, because D.C. for a long time has been one of the leading education reform cities in the country, mm-hmm. both with a huge charter sector, about half the kids, a high performing charter sector, and a traditional public school system that has, by many accounts, gotten much better over time. And it strikes me that D.C., at least recently, has been able to avoid a lot of the crazy politics that you see in other big cities, blue cities today. Had Mark Leeson on a few weeks ago from Philadelphia, might be another example of a city that seems to be doing okay in terms of the politics of this issue. And yet we're starting to maybe see some signs in D.C. that trouble is brewing. There's a bill to require, quote, transparency in the charter sector.
Indeed, there are two.
Two bills, okay, to do that. I guess what the one that I saw included something about teachers' names and salaries, which might be, as the Washington Post editorial board pointed out, particularly helpful to, say, a teachers' union that might want to organize those charter teachers. So tell us, Jessica, now that you've been on the State Board of Education for about
104 days,
yes, newly elected, what do you see happening in D.C.? Should we be worried that D.C. is going in the same direction as, say, a Chicago or a Los Angeles or a New York City?
So I would offer sort of two insights on that. One, I think D.C. is a great city for ed reform, and I would offer that every charter sector is different, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
So D.C.'s is different from any of the other states that yep. have charter sectors, and I think ours is pretty great. We have nonprofit operators. We have an outstanding authorizer.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of choice in the city in yep. public schools. And so we have a robust sector. We've got about half the kids in the city going to public schools, and their families often have kids in both sectors.
Yep.
So we've managed to avoid some of the political fractioning mm-hmm. that has happened in other places. That said, I don't think we can get complacent.
Yeah.
I think those of us who care about high quality schools and we care about school choice have to remember that when people call out for changes, yeah. something is not satisfying them. Something is afoot.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things I'd love to see us pay more attention to in D.C. is, why are people calling for transparency? What kinds of things have they felt are not happening in mm-hmm. their child's school? So I did a dissertation on charter school closures in mm-hmm. D.C., and one of my key findings was that families were often not brought into the process about decisions to restart
yeah.
until very late in the game, if at all. So I wonder, have we brought in families enough? Have we been proactive in our engagement? Is mm-hmm. this a sign that we haven't? Have we thought about teachers, right? When I was a charter teacher, I was a founding teacher at a charter school. I got to help write the curriculum. I got to help set the policies. Teachers get involved in smaller schools, in autonomous schools, because they want to have voice.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we fail to do so, to give them voice, to give them accesses for that, they're going to keep asking. Teachers
yeah.
are, empowered people. They work really hard on behalf of their students. And I think we need to think about how have we listened to teacher voice or failed to do so.
All right. So I mean, you're saying that there are some legitimate issues. I mean, which I guess I'm coming at this kind of cynically, right? Which is to say, both parties have gone crazy, right? And now in the Democratic Party, you've got this race to the left where there's these litmus tests and these people saying, waking up all of a sudden saying, how is it that progressives can be in favor of something like charter schools? And
Mike, you do realize it's primary season.
It is, yes. Okay. Does it ever end? Primary season? It goes on forever. What are you talking about? Not like a season.
I didn't say it was a short season.
A year.
saying it's
Game of Thrones.
Season.
I mean, it has, the winter is coming thing, but at least that's only like, what, 6 episodes long this time around?
Yeah, we're into the general election yeah.
All right. So, it can feel like, all right, like a college debate, and all of a sudden somebody wakes up and says, I'm progressive and I don't think we should support charter schools, and it's a litmus test. But that's not what you're saying. You're saying that you think there are some legitimate issues where, say, some school closures weren't handled as well as they could have been, where some of the promise of charters empowering teacher voice hasn't always been kept. So that those are things that are worth digging in.
Yeah, I'd say that's right. I think that we have to always remember that ed reform is an evolving concept, and children are always changing and schooling is changing. And so if we're going to keep saying that ed reform is an innovative opportunity, an opportunity to get better from where we are today, then we have to be self-reflective about where our places we can get better, and ideally to stay ahead of the curve and not wait for someone to say, well, you better get better. And shake their finger at us, but instead to sort of stay ahead of it. I think one of those opportunities is around special education. Okay. Students with disabilities are not being served well in many education settings.
Yeah.
And here in DC, we have a lot of students with disabilities being served in charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
I see a great opportunity for people to come together around the issue of how are we serving students with disabilities? Yeah. How are we doing it in charter schools? How are we doing it in our neighborhood traditional public schools? How are we doing it in our selective high schools, where our enrollment for special ed is significantly lower than in either our charter schools, which are citywide open enrollment, no testing allowed, and in our neighborhood DCPS high schools. We're seeing increased numbers of kids with special ed needs in all of those schools, and we're not seeing them in our tested high schools.
Yeah.
To me, that's an interesting conversation. How are we serving kids? How are we serving them well across all settings? How are we
thinking? And those tested high schools in the district.
In the district, in the traditional public schools. Yeah.
Right.
And I think, as parents call for more information, more insight, more access, if we think about ways to give that to them proactively, and we think about key issues we can hone in on, I think we're going to get better.
So it still sounds, it sounds like the discussion in DC, though, still is much healthier. I mean, it's focused on substance, it's focused on improvement versus some of the vitriol that you see in other places.
We try hard.
All right. Way to go, DC. And the question is why, right? And I'm curious for both of you, and there's many possibilities, right? It's that the DC public schools were so badly broken. Nobody could deny it that created this opening, and there's a sense of progress. There's the gentrification of the city, which, people feel like you have this, when a city is growing and thriving, that makes changes.
There's
easier.
More pie.
You've got more money, crazy amount of money in DC being spent on these things. That helps everybody feel better. You've got a teachers union that at one point was completely devastated by a scandal. And so that's an issue. I mean, which of these things?
Mike, you're missing
matter?
The obvious.
Charters?
You've got like thousands of people who are obsessed with public policy, legitimately. I think DC is one of the more misunderstood places in the world, honestly. Americans hate it, but and I sort of hate the people in charge too, most days, right? But at the ground level, DC is teeming with people who talk substantively about policy all the time. I don't know. Has that been your experience?
So you're talking about real DC.
I'm talking about real DC.
He's talking about the capital D district of Columbia.
Yeah.
I get that it's not all of DC, but it is a critical mass.
So because you've got a bunch of technocrats in the district that leads to good government in the DC government?
One of many factors.
Okay.
I would also add in, you have a lot of people who have been, I don't love this term, but I'm going to use it for expediency's sake, sector switchers, who have worked in both DC public schools and in public charter schools. They have been in education for a while. They are often on the leading edge of the work in DC. Yeah. So I think about some of the good opportunities that have already happened for collaboration. Got a master's in executive leadership at Georgetown that is partnering DC public schools principals and charter school leaders in cohorts together. So you're building professional learning communities, professional relationships of school leaders, and you're not You're not dividing them by sector. And I think that's a big deal. You've got Two Rivers Public Charter School in Ward 6 and Ward 5, who are, it's an expeditionary learning school that is doing this consistent work around deeper learning.
Yeah.
And they offer to have presentations by teachers from DC Public and traditional public and charter schools. And they invite in the whole community to come learn about this work. So I think you've got people who really keep the best interests of kids at heart and have been in the work on both sides of the ed reform equation.
Well, God bless them. Look, it sounds a lot better than we see in many places. You do wonder, I mean, I think all these factors, right? And the fact that DC got to close to 50% charter market share very fast. And that gave the charter sector a lot of political clout, right? Because you've got all these parents that are getting served by these charters. And once that happens, I mean, if you get to the point where you say charters are not going away and they cannot be used as a political punching bag because they have strength in numbers, you know, then that changes the dynamic. Versus, look, in New York, in Los Angeles, Chicago, lots of kids in charter schools, but still as a percentage basis, relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you haven't reached that point where there's that raw political power, it seems like. And so there still are incentives to try to keep charters down and to have, you know, for the fight to constantly be district versus charter, instead of being able to get past that, talk about quality and talk about how do we make the whole system better.
I built on David's point, too, about the technocrats that live in town. So the council member who advanced the transparency legislation is my council member, Charles Allen, our council member.
Yeah.
And I had a really good conversation with him about some concerns that I have about some of the details of the bill.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the feedback I've gotten from parents who say, I get the spirit of the bill, but here are my issues. Mm-hmm. They are deeply weedy, technocratic issues. I'm getting emails from FOIA attorneys who are Ward 6 parents who are discussing in detail their finer points of the legislation. So I think the fact that we have a conversation that is about the merits of the policy rather than about shouting at one another over this or that, I think it's a benefit.
Yeah.
I'm a nerd. I love this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with finer points being debated on a policy issue. But I think everyone's in it because we want great schools for all of our kids.
Nerds united.
I was just going to say, that's so interesting. That makes three nerds. Yeah.
God, I want to be more cynical about it, but I can't. You're too positive.
Yeah, we're overwhelming you. It'll be okay, Mike.
It's so great. Although it does raise a question about why, when you've got all these same types of people that live, say, in Montgomery County, Prince George's County, there is not the same fervor for improvement. So my suggestion, a bunch of you need to move to Prince George's County, where the schools don't get nearly enough money and are not performing particularly well. That's our next thing. DC, check. We're done. On to Prince George's County. And then take Montgomery County after that, because we get a lot of issues. All right. Hey, Jessica, thanks so much for coming on the show. Hope you'll come back sometime soon.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Mike. I always enjoy conversations with fellow edu nerds.
All right, good. All right, well, if you're an edu nerd, then you're excited because it is now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
We were just nerding out with Jessica there. I tell you, you know, part of the argument is why DC is doing so well. It's because it's a city full of technocrats who are getting involved in improving their schools. I know. So what we need to do is when we, you know, these proposals to send parts of the federal government out to other cities and regions that perhaps are not doing so well economically, and then those technocrats will go with them.
Right.
Yeah. And they can spread education reform as a part of the plan.
You write the best campaign slogans.
Yeah, you like that? So we'll send some to Richmond and fix those Richmond schools.
Yes.
How about that?
How about a
charter school law in Virginia?
Would that be nice? Right. This is why I'm interested in helping out with Cristo Rey at this point in Richmond, because there are no charter schools. Yes. So
crazy.
Anyhow.
All right, what you got for us?
We got a new study in the Economics of Education Review by Matt Steinberg and John McDonald looking at the impact of Philadelphia school closures on student achievement and behavioral outcomes. This is the new little wrinkle with this.
Mm-hmm.
They actually look at absences and OSS, the impact of closures on those things.
Out-of-school suspensions.
Okay. The new wrinkle. And they cited our Ohio study on school closures. The school district of Philadelphia closed more than 10% of its traditional schools between the 2011-2012 and 2012-13 school years, which included the lowest performing and most under-enrolled schools. 20 schools closed in the study time frame those couple years. About 3,800 students displaced. They use grade 3-8 student level data for students attending the traditional schools in the 2010-11 through 2015-16 school years. They use a panel, this is for David, they use a panel difference in differences approach.
Hey.
You too, Mike.
Yeah, Mike too.
A panel difference in differences approach, which compares changes in student outcomes for displaced students required to change schools and their receiving school peers relative to students attending schools that did not receive displaced students in the year after closure. They are able to show that the pre-closure student achievement trends evolve similarly for the three groups, David, that you always ask me about those pre-trends. Since displaced students exited on average lower performing and more disadvantaged schools. So in other words, you know, the kids are coming obviously from worse schools. The change in outcomes might actually be just a simple reflection of these schools that are incorporating these students from these worse schools, right? So they separate the effect out by closures on displaced students and students in the receiving schools, as well as distinguish between students in non-closed schools that did and did not receive displaced students. So in other words, there are so many groups in this paper.
I think there was a similar study in New York or something like that. It took a similar approach.
Yes. Okay. So just know that they did their homework. Findings: closing schools had no impact on the average academic achievement of displaced students. However, achievement improved significantly for displaced students who enrolled in, what you think?
Better schools.
Better schools.
How'd you forget that?
I know. Because I know. See, and you were making fun of me, huh? Like, I don't get it.
And schools with a lower concentration of displaced students.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
In contrast, students attending schools that received the displaced students experienced, what do you think?
Lower achievement.
A significant decline in academic achievement.
Because peer effects are a real thing.
Specifically, they experienced a decrease of 0.04 standard deviation in math and that persisted to the end of year two. The ELA achievement declined for those kids by 0.06 standard deviation by the end of the second year. The decline in achievement was greatest for students attending schools with the highest concentration of displaced students, which was about 25% was the cutoff they were looking at there. School closures also affected behavioral outcomes for both displaced and receiving school peers. First, for the displaced kids, closures significantly increased the days of school missed due to absences. The impact was even more negative for, feel like a broken record, displaced students attending schools with a higher concentration of other displaced kids. Next, absences and OSS days increased as the distance displaced students traveled to their new schools increased. So those that traveled an additional 1 mile to their new school realized a 5% increase in days missed due to OSS. Finally, OSS and absences were greatest among the receiving school students whose schools had the highest concentration of displaced students compared to receiving schools that had lower concentrations. Whew, that was a lot, wasn't it? In short, what's
And
the
by
big,
the way, was this over how many years of data are we talking about? This all happens in the
this
first
was,
year?
Was, they were looking at 2 years, but they were looking at kids from 2010 through 2016.
All right, but it wasn't just in the very first year that these changes were made.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. They looked, I think.
Because usually, you know, some of the findings is that, you know, not unusual for achievement to decline in that first year.
When I think it was 3 years they looked at after the closure.
Okay. Yep.
So I don't know. There's basically there's a number of spillover effects or a number of direct effects, but it seemed to me like same thing we've heard before. Kids need to go to higher performing schools, right? Like that's the big change. They got to happen. And what was new here was just the concentration of the cohort, right? Of the displaced kids that you can't, you know, you got to be careful about putting like so many in one school, right?
Yeah.
So.
Was I getting that right? I mean, basically the interpretation is that if they all go in one big group and it's a third of the new school or whatever, a quarter you said, presumably the culture of the old school comes with them.
I mean, that's right. And change.
At least that was my interpretation. I mean, that's intuitive to me. I'm not sure what to say about
right? I know.
And it's hard. I mean, what are they, I mean, because these closures, you know, need to happen sometimes.
Yes.
I mean, and we're going to see more of it. We've got declining enrollment in a lot of places. We've got a declining birth rate.
Well, and this is
You know, somebody doesn't want to let immigrants into the country. You know, So, I'm just saying that if, you know, that there's going to be getting weird looks.
How did you get from, anyway?
I know.
Declining enrollment.
Okay. Anyhow.
Zero to controversy. In two seconds, folks.
Fine.
Look,
fine,
all right. So, I mean, one of my big things on closure is, institutions have the memory, right? Mm-hmm. Like schools have a culture. It's so hard, you know, even if you're the, it's like the old adage in, right, saying in DC, it's like the secretary doesn't change the department, right? The department changes the secretary. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so hard, even for people who are in charge, mm-hmm. to change the culture of things. And, you know, I mean, to me, that's a big reason why, even though it's such a hard thing, I think school closure makes intuitive sense to me, because it is very difficult to change patterns of behavior that are built mm-hmm. into the way people interact with each other.
But you got to worry about messing up the nearby school.
Right.
So that is an issue. And it sounds right. like, and it's tough. I mean, how do you ideally split kids up in lots of different directions?
But that's, and how many high performing schools can you split them into?
I was going to say that just may not be right. so feasible.
And the cutoff they were looking at was 7% or yeah. less. Like, 7% or less seem to be like how many kids you can drop in. Like, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think about it, right? You're a new kid in a new class in a new school, right? You're going to keep your head down and watch and see what everybody else is doing, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're going to do the same thing, right? But if you're 7 or 8 or 10 new kids in a new class in a new school, you're mm-hmm. going to do what you've always done, because you see, right. you know, Jimmy and Tommy, and you guys are always, you right. know.
You're all together again.
You're all together again, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know what to yeah. say. I mean, obviously, it works better if there's more schools around, right?
High-performing schools
obviously high-performing schools, mm-hmm. but, I mean, honestly, any schools, right? Isn't that the implication of the study,
well, just,
too?
Right. They just need to be spread out, right?
Right. Right. Just that it would be better not to, I don't know, dump them all into the school next door, yeah. right?
Right.
It's interesting that the yeah. politics of this are so...
But then you got to worry about the travel, right? Like, that was the other spin on this, that you can't ship them too far away either, because then you see some right. negative effects there.
And it was interesting, not just on attendance, which you'd expect because it's right. harder to get to, but that they actually get suspended more often.
Right.
And I guess
yeah.
What,
yeah, that
they
was
behave
interesting too.
Worse when they're not in their own neighborhood, or who
yeah,
knows what.
I don't know either.
Yeah, it's just interesting how backwards the politics are relative to what we actually worry about, right? I mean, yeah. nobody is saying, oh, for this, well, maybe they are, but most people aren't objecting to school closure because the kids will go somewhere else, right? Yeah. Or that's not usually how it's framed.
Yeah.
It's usually about the kids in the school, but yeah. all the studies say they're, you know, basically, I don't know, not that affected.
Right. But it's the other schools that are. All right. Yeah. Whew, some tough stuff. This is not yeah. easy, nope. but great studies.
Yes.
So great study. Nice find. All right. Well,
he's an EAP, Matthew Steinberg, by
yes,
the way.
He is. Yes, he's done some great work for us.
Yes.
All right. That is all the time that we've got. So until next week,
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.